True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any episodes of the program or breaking updates as we have them for you. On today's episode, we're going to take a look at the defense of this case and the defense of Brian Koberger and talk to a criminal defense attorney who has seen quite a few very high-profile cases in her time, and really get into a discussion about the reality, not just public opinion, not just what's going on a message board or a Facebook discussion group, but more so what truly could be presented in court, what could be dismissed in court, what could be poked through as we now begin to wait for the time period up until June 26th of this year when the preliminary hearing will take place. Lotta Yuretsian is joining us. She's a criminal defense attorney. Lotta, I want to start here because I was watching you the other day on an interview and you noted that in this case, what I've noticed is they've got evidence and they've tried to put together the pieces of the puzzle, but each and every one of the pieces of the puzzle seem to have issues and weaknesses in places where the defense attorney can poke holes. That's what you had just said. Tell me about that. Let's dig into that a little bit deeper. What kind of holes do you see where the defense can focus on?
Clearly, they've got a story and they've got all sorts of evidence, including forensic evidence. And also, we've got the shoe prints. And I'll start with that.
Okay.
The shoe prints. My understanding is those are Van's shoe prints. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that comes to mind, as soon as I hear the word Vans, I'm thinking probably 50% of the youth, if not the population of at least the United States, have at some point in their lives had a pair of Vans. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a large number of people who could be, you know, who are owners. And it just doesn't narrow down the group enough for an affidavit in support of a probable cause for an arrest. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one. And I'm sure that the defense is going to have a field day with that one, unless there are specific markers, whether it be the size, or there's a special pattern to this particular Vans, it's a special model, or the wear and tear on the soles. It could be all sorts of things, right, that they could later pinpoint that can point directly at the suspect, and that would only happen if they can find the shoes themselves. So then they could say, all right, these prints match shoes we found at his home in his closet, and we've got photos that he's been wearing and this and that. So, and we don't have any of that, at least not yet. You never know, in the future we may have those, but for now I don't see it in the affidavit. All I see is a pair of Vans, and you know, there's more to it. My understanding is that there were friends who came to the residence after the murders, and also one of the witnesses who had seen the suspect was possibly wearing Vans, and some of the friends may have been wearing Vans. There were officers who were at the scene, and my understanding, they had not covered their shoes when they walked into the residence, and then we've got contamination. So there's also all sorts of issues that can be raised by the defense team here as far as the Vans. The bushy eyebrows is another one. Mm-hmm. One would think that's another character or trait that's pretty common among males in the United States or elsewhere. So, and how do we decide what's bushy? How bushy do these eyebrows need to be for them to be considered bushy? And again, it's not a very specific thing that narrows the group of suspects or potential suspects. Again, very common, and a defense team would have a field day with that. There was also evidence related to the cell site information, at least in the affidavit. What they were talking about was that his cell phone had used towers or a tower that covered the area of the residence. And, you know, he lived anywhere from 8 to 10 miles from the University of Idaho. That's pretty close to the residence. And sometimes cell towers can cover areas or a radius of anywhere from 5 to even 15, especially in rural areas. You don't have too many of them. So they cover large areas. And it doesn't really mean that he was physically near the residence. It just means that his cell tower, his cell phone picked up or used that specific cell tower. Again, it doesn't tell us exactly physically where he was. Now, there's other ways of showing that. There's other ways of showing it, and they may have that evidence. I just didn't see it in the affidavit, and that's all I'm saying. Again, a defense attorney is going to bring those up. Again, later, the prosecution may have further evidence, including sometimes there's evidence where they can literally tell how far a particular phone was from the cell tower. They can get that kind of information as well. And I don't, there's no mention of it in here. I don't know if they've got it or not. There could be Wi-Fi related things where his phone may have touched Wi-Fi. We don't know. Again, I don't have any of it. All I'm saying is, based on what I'm reading in the affidavit, a defense attorney could, again, have a field day with us. And there's more. And if you have specific questions, I'm here to answer.
Would you expect all of those details, though, to be in the affidavit for his arrest? Because obviously they just need to put just enough in there to reasonably arrest the man. They don't need to lay out all their cards. So you're making very good points. And I understand, yeah, those are very good points. But I do also wonder how much more is behind these just, you know, above the rim pieces that we've seen thus far that really completely do back up those points.
And I agree with you. There may be a lot more behind the scenes that we don't know, but usually officers will put their strongest evidence in the affidavit for the probable cause for the arrest, right? They're trying to convince a judge that this is the right guy, that they've got probable cause that he committed this crime, that a crime was committed and he committed this crime. And yes, the threshold may not be too high, but you would expect the law enforcement to put in accurate information and also their what they consider to be their strongest evidence, right, at the time. And they were still investigating, and we know they continue to investigate this matter, right? Because my understanding is there were a couple of search warrants today. So yes, and of course I would expect them to put these types of things in their affidavit, because sometimes the argument is that it's not just one evidence that points at guilt or a particular suspect. It's a combination of a number of evidence where you circumstantially build your case, which is what they're trying to do here, because no one in reality saw the face of the perpetrator.
That's very true. When you have all these pieces of evidence coming together, some of the points that you had brought up, the shoes, yes, very common, unless there's a real definitive piece there. Probably not one of the strongest pieces. The eyebrows also, yes. And the fact that he was wearing a mask. I know there's some discussion of, was it a ski mask? Was it a COVID type mask? How well was that seen in the dark? And yes, a common trait. And those pieces are some of the ones that we do know. But given that there does seem to be, there is, at least we know one piece of DNA evidence, one would guess there's probably much more. And there's probably more with the cell phone. As a defense attorney, would you, when you're defending a client, your main thing, though, would not necessarily be to spend a lot of time, I'm assuming, on the pieces that are very hard to argue, or really there's not a lot of holes that can be poked. Would it be more so sowing doubt in the area of things like the shoes, of the eyebrows? How does all of this work in terms of how you'd represent a client in court with some fairly damning evidence?
Obviously, you would focus on every piece of evidence. You can't ignore the damning evidence and only focus on things, areas where you think you can poke holes, because sometimes even the damning evidence, including DNA, you may have some way of poking holes in that evidence, because sometimes there are issues, right?
Okay.
And we've had cases before. Years ago, I was a younger attorney at an office, and we had a case, and there was a rape allegation, and they had done DNA testing, and it came back basically, you know, the result was, it's a match for your client. And once we pushed and had them continue that testing and go down the chain, the DNA chain, what they realized was, wait a minute. No, this is not him. Yes, there are some markers here that are common within that ethnic group that individual belongs to. Mm-hmm. But then when you do a deeper dive and a more comprehensive testing, it's pretty obvious it's not a match. So, or there could be other issues. Again, we don't know the details. I wouldn't ignore anything as a defense attorney.
Sure. Knowing what we know and what we did see initially in the case, prior to the FBI being involved in those first handful of days watching the footage of the crime scene, as a defense attorney and you're seeing that, how contaminated do you think that scene was from what we've known and seen?
My understanding is it was contaminated. My understanding is there were a few individuals that actually came into the place, non-law enforcement. And also law enforcement went in without having covered their shoes. So there's clearly contamination. Now, how much, it's tough for me to tell, but I can see a good defense attorney, and it looks like he's got a very skilled and very capable counsel, will be raising the flags on that issue.
When you look at the case as a defense attorney, if you were to hypothetically say you were representing Brian Koberger, bring us into what those conversations would be like as an attorney to him and advising him. What would you be saying to him at this moment as we begin to enter into the discovery phase before the June 26 hearing?
I mean, you would do what you would typically do with any client. You would sit and have a conversation with your client and understand, first and foremost, what his story is, what happened that day, where he was. Mm-hmm. And assuming the client is saying, I didn't do this, it's not me. Or if he has explanations for some of the evidence, then you start going through each and every piece of the evidence and find out how you explain each and every piece of those, each and every piece from his point of view, all right? And then depending on what he says, if he says, I was in the area 12 times because I work in the area, or I've got a very close friend that I visit, then you get an investigator and you start corroborating all that evidence. But the first thing is to have a heart-to-heart with your client. And hopefully the client is honest with you and get a lay of the land, figure out what was going on with him, what happened, does he know these people, gather your information, right? And then based on what he says, figure out what your defense is and start collecting the corroborating evidence and interviewing people, getting your private investigator, your PI, to investigate, to start interviewing people. So there's a lot going on, but the one thing that you have to tell your client is, especially now that he's represented, that you don't talk to anybody about this case. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about the facts of the case, not just law enforcement. That's a given. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But you don't talk about it to family when they call you over the phone, when you're an inmate, everything is being recorded. Mm-hmm. You do not discuss the facts. You ignore all of that. You talk about maybe what's going on in your life. Hey, ask them what's going on in their lives, this and that. But nothing that comes near this case. You don't talk to any of the inmates about the case, basically. And in court, always try to keep your composure, nothing on your face, no emotions, no outbursts. Basically, quietly follow the case. You want to take notes, take notes. You want to speak to me, but never directly to the court. Everything you have to say, if ever asked anything, first look at me. And only if I nod, then you can answer if it's a yes or a no. Sometimes there's certain things that the courts will ask that he has to respond to. But everything has to go through counsel.
How does that work for you once you have that heart-to-heart with a client? And I don't know if you've had this situation before, and I'm not speaking specifically of this case, but what do you do in the situation where you sit down, you talk, and you, as a human being, don't believe what they're saying? You really think that they're lying to you, but you are hired as their defense. How does that play out?
You know, your job is to advocate. Mm-hmm. And it's not to judge. And you have to do your job regardless of what you're thinking at the moment.
Sure.
Unless you've got real, some kind of proof where the client actually told you, let's say, yes, I was here at such and such location, and then wants to testify and lie about it, then clearly there's some ethical rules that govern in those situations.
Sure.
But if the client hasn't told you and everything you're doing is not contradictory to anything anything that you're presenting, mm-hmm. evidence that you're presenting is not contradictory to things that the client has told you, mm-hmm. then you do what's best for your client. You advocate for the client. You defend the client best you can, mm-hmm. regardless of what you're feeling intuitively, because your intuition could be wrong.
Sure.
Your job isn't to do things based on your intuition.
It's, no.
It's to defend him. Or sure. her, the best you can.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of get that slice of the psychology of it from your perspective, because we don't often hear how that kind of plays out for individuals in your type of position. When you are going through something like this, and let's just hypothetically say, obviously there are some pieces here that seem to have ability to poke through. We don't know obviously what's going to be coming through in discovery. Is there ever situations where there is just so much damning evidence that you would advise your client that the best route here is to plead guilty and make a plea for your life, take the death penalty off the table? Or is it always to be, you know, look, we're going to go fight this, or do you give them the choice and kind of give them an idea of the likelihood of them being convicted?
As a criminal defense attorney, your job is to explain everything to your client. Explain to him what the law is. Explain to him what the evidence is, which parts are problematic, which parts are helpful to him. And basically, explain to the client what you think is the best decision here. But that's your job. My job is to give him the lay of the land, explain to him what his chances are, but really in detail, go through the evidence, go through all the possible defenses, all the possible resolutions. Is there an alternative way of resolving this? What are the chances of winning? What are the chances of losing? What happens if we lose? Just talk about everything, right? Sentencing. Once you explain all of that to the client, then it's really up to the client as far as the risks involved and whether he or she wants to take the risk of going to trial. Sometimes the evidence could be very damning, but the client presses on and says, no, I didn't do this. And they're adamant, or they just want to fight it. And it's their decision. You can't force them to take a deal. You can suggest it. You can tell them it's in your interest to take the deal. Let me try and get you something that doesn't involve the death penalty or whatever it may be, or a determinant, a number, 10 years, 5 years, 2 years, 1 year versus the life that you're facing, right? If you go to trial and lose. But at the end of the day, it's the client's decision. And as lawyers, all we can do is suggest and make recommendations and explain everything, make sure they've got all the information they need to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And at the end, it's their decision. Whatever the client wants is what's going to happen, because it's a huge risk.
Sure. One more question, and just opinion based on what we know thus far. Where are you seeing this going? Where does your gut and your experiences tell us this is going to be heading as we get closer and closer to June?
It's looking like the prelim is going to be in June, and it looks like the investigation is continuing. And my guess is that they're going to start getting their hands on more and more evidence, whether it be incriminating or maybe exonerating. We'll have to see. But I would guess, like you said earlier, that they've got more than what we were given. And even the affidavit, it's got some sections that have been redacted.
Yeah.
And that tells you something. That tells you that there's more that we're not seeing. And clearly there's an ongoing investigation. And it could be that's why some of these paragraphs are redacted. Or it could be that there's sensitive information in there. Bottom line is, we know that they're gathering more evidence and they're trying to solidify their case. I'm talking about the prosecution here.
Sure.
As far as the prelim is concerned, it doesn't really take much. It's just a probable cause finding. A probable cause finding that a crime occurred, and then this is the individual who committed it. It's not a very high threshold. I've said it before, sometimes it just takes a warm body sitting next to you for them to be held to answer. And in a case like this, I wouldn't be surprised, unless there's some bombshell exonerating evidence. He's going to be held to answer, and this is going to end up either going to trial or we're going to have some kind of a plea.
Yeah. One more thing that I just thought of with the psychological aspect of this case, there's been a lot of information that has come out online that is very much likely to be him. Some of the aspects from his study of criminology, almost asking for a guidebook on how to feel and how to act when performing such a crime, to another piece from his youth from about 10 to 12 years ago that seemed to be almost a look into his mind, talking about him being disassociative with reality and with his family and emotions and things of that nature. Do you think there'll be a mental health aspect brought up in this case?
I wouldn't be surprised. If it's there and the evidence is damning, I would be surprised if the defense team doesn't look into it. Now, at the end of the day, I don't know if they're going to end up bringing it up. They may or may not, but they have to look into it. That they're going to do. That's going to be part of their due diligence in representing their client. And they will make the decision if it's going to be helpful to him to focus on that in a trial or to bring it up. It could be brought up in a mitigation type of situation. It could be brought up at a sentencing. I don't know when they're going to bring it up, but it all depends on what they find out. And I'm sure they may end up doing a psych eval and we'll only get a glimpse of that if they decide to use it. Otherwise, we won't even know what that is,
sure,
what the results are.
Lottie Uretzian, criminal defense attorney, thank you for joining us and giving us your insights on this case. We do greatly appreciate it. That's going to wrap up today's episode of the University of Idaho Murders podcast, Four Killed for What? Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking updates and conversations on the case. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. I'm Tony Brewski. For all of us here at True Crime Today, thanks for listening.